librarian at Cornell found a database that contributed to the Office of Foreign Library of Congress. Probably 39. So Vietnam was all settled. But then I started going over to Cambodia. That was a popular place for IBS to get there.
Angkor Wat.
Drugs were $4 a kilo for marijuana. They used to go there and get stoned for a week on end. And it was peaceful at the time. It was just a glorious place to go. Good food. You could speak Vietnamese in Cambodia. So I started going there, and I wrote back to the guy who made a self-stage collection and said, I'd be happy to pick up what I could do. One of the things you always try to get is statistical stuff. So I went to the Statistics Bureau of Congress. I was a librarian there, and listened to purchase periodicals and books from Cornell. And he did such a good job. Well, I used to go there and physically bring them out because we didn't really trust the post that much. But I used to go and physically bring them out and go there periodically. I would also pay them in cash at the legal exchange rate, which was, you know, maybe 6 or 7 times. So you make an enormous profit on this by his standards, but still Cornell was getting excellent bargains. And it turned out that after Pol Pot destroyed the library, that many of the only surviving issues of books and periodicals were at Cornell. It was the New York Times about 5 years ago. Albert Compton Library was rebuilding based on stuff that got from Cornell University. And most of that stuff I brought out. I actually started going there much more frequently again later on, starting in about 71. I went when the worst years of the war in the country, I was going there every 2 or 3 months. It was a quick trip, 35 minutes wide. And I had more money at the time. So it was easier. I didn't go. I probably went once or twice a year when I was in IBS. And then once I went to Burma, that was expensive. So I went once. Nimi, I'm busy up here.
You went with Betty Wilkinson, who lives nearby, and you went to Mandalay?
Yep.
For the flying pigs.
That was quite a I actually had to, I called my friend.
It used to cost $11 to fly from Los Angeles to San Francisco. When, how did you feel when that second tour was up? How did you feel?
Well, I had gotten a job with Pan Am. I wanted to stay in Vietnam. I thought my time teaching was probably up, pretty much, you know, done what I wanted to do there. But I was very sad to be signed on. And it turned out, I worked for Pan Am, a 5-day-a-week job. I often went back to Sun Ron on weekends.
Well, let me slow this down a little bit. You finished your second tour with IBS in 71, so it'd be like July of 71.
Yep.
And how did you find out about the Pan Am?
I might have heard about it from a friend who had already been working there. They were looking for somebody.
And this was in China?
No, it was in Cantu, originally. I spent 15 months in Canada. And 9 of them were in Cantu, and then they closed Cantu. And the last 6 months were a running ticket office in Long Bin in Vietnam. This was a military
thing, right on.
It was a fun job, and I was paid, something like $600 a month. That's the principal job. I had an apartment I rented in Saigon, and I had a number of chums who were studying in Saigon, living there. People come there, they use it as a place to stay when they're in Saigon, take tests or bring a relative to the hospital or something like that. And I went back to, I didn't go back to Phan Rang every weekend, but I probably went once a month. You know, air traffic is free in Vietnam. So why not? Just go up here up this Saturday morning and come back Sunday night.
And after 15 months?
Then I got a Fulbright grant to teach the University of Goa. That was my last 4 years, my last year. That was my last, I was there in 75, but that was my last job. Mm-hmm. I was a Fulbright professor.
So,
and I really didn't enjoy it. I didn't like it a lot. I didn't much enjoy teaching at the university level.
Well, how was that?
I don't know. I just simply didn't like the students as much. And not that they were bad people. They were okay, but the challenge was such wonderful people that I was spoiled.
plus they had hot showers in the lot, a couple of hot showers you could pay, and you didn't have hot water. So that was quite a luxury. Plus they had some very nice restaurants and wonderful vegetables, way better than the lot. But the year I lived there, I just didn't enjoy it at all. And there I literally went down to Toronto and worked hard on every weekend. I'd park two days on Saturday. Saturday afternoon I'd be on the bus out of Toronto and Saigon every
Saturday. When was the Fulbright running from?
That was the 72-73 school year. Classes didn't start until sometime in November. I took some time off after Pan Am. I needed to fly for free, so I went back to the United States. In Europe, really. I went to the U.S. for 2 days. And came back, and I remember coming back in October, and I probably spent the rest of October in Palma. And then went up to the lot when school started in November.
And when the Fulbright was over,
I came back to the United States. I came home, I got tickets to come home, and come home anywhere you wanted, it was a decent distance. So I went to Saigon, Phnom Penh, Bangkok, Tehran, Damascus, Beirut, Istanbul, Sofia, Bucharest, Rome, Paris, London, Belfast. It was an incredible trip. About 5 days in Western Ireland, sitting at the beach, because everyone said you would leave Vietnam, you have to do some grass.
And I started Western Ireland where?
Light Lahin, a resort town. And then I started law school.
So when is the next time you went back to Vietnam?
Summer of 74.
Why did you do that, or what was the second?
I wanted to go. You know, I was living there for all practical purposes. I maintained my apartment. So as soon as school was out, I went back to Vietnam. And I got a little bit of money from Cornell to photograph Tom manuscripts. A lot of these people have these manuscripts in the house. But, you know, these things are going to be lost unless somebody does something about it. So I went back to Phan Rang and I took about 120 rolls of film. And brought them back to the library where they're now being cataloged. And based on that, I got a Ford Foundation grant to go back next year and do something much more ambitious, you know, cover a lot more area. Now, mind you, I was just blind. I didn't know what I was taking pictures of. But it really didn't matter. It was a preservation project. It was just everything that I did.
You got a Ford Foundation for the next year.
Yeah,
the next year was 75.
Yeah.
What happened then?
I went back. I went back in 75.
And what month?
January. Stopped in Phnom Penh. That was not pleasant. I worked for during the months of January and February. Phnom Rang. It was actually northern Phnom Penh area, where I really didn't know as many people. They were not in our school district, so that was also a Cham area. So, because it was going to be more difficult for me, because people were suspicious of me. I was just going in and taking pictures of their, that was considered to be very valuable property. You had to be introduced by people, you had to go in and see them and all that. So, that was the last time that happened.
Do you have any sense that the ship was hitting the fan?
No. Well, you know, I should have, because in January of 75, North Vietnamese captured the provincial capital not too far from Saigon. It was the first time they had done that. And there had been no American reaction.
No, that was Ben Cook?
No, that was Cook Long.
Cook Long, right.
I didn't have to call them. And you frankly knew any more Vietnamese.
No, not really.
It was a
test.
Yeah. Cook Long was really a test. We kind of waited to see if the Americans were doing it. And yet Congress, far from increasing aid, cut it back. So I was in Bantam Stewart when I was taking a break. And I'll tell you, we had once the school got to we were right next to a training center for pop the IVF house in Songdae, Hookwong was destroyed. I don't know what happened to her, really, except for what was invalid there in the book. But I did, unfortunately, even during the head attack, they didn't have that coming. So. And I wasn't back again until 1988.
And after 1988, you started going back rather frequently.
Well, 88, 89, 90, and 91, I went back quite a few years.
What were you doing?
Just being friends.
You were doing any work before now, or it was just trips?
Oh, I always pick up books. I expect not to do it. Now they're more than things like that. Just trips to be there and see, and walk along. And those things were amazing. And not heavily untoured. That first trip to Hanoi, Libby and I went, is that what you mean? Phil was just American in the city. And I was back there in 92 when there were four of us coming through and making a call like that.
Quite something to say. Like a lot, but the joke used to be all the Americans, all the Vietnamese knew all the Americans who were in Hanoi. Everyone knew who you were.
Well, and they had to stay in a certain hotel in theory, and the computers for the hotels were interconnected. So I spent one day hiding the day at Hanoi Central Records in 3 days. Not a easy place to find people. And they told me, they checked all the hotels, and said, you can't be here, not any of the hotels. Well, he was in the Farm Ministry guest house, which is all private persons in the hotel. I forget how I found that out, but I did find it out. But they checked all the Americans in the city.
Well, they used to be a 4th of July party, but it just got too big.
Yeah.
And so it stopped.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember being in rather remote U.S. places.
Yeah.
And everyone would be at the 4th of July party, and that was the one time you heard together because it was so small and disparate. But like in Paris, the embassy doesn't throw a 4th of July party for all the Americans,
you know,
in Paris, so eventually it became like that in Hanoi. When you look back, what do you think about your idea?
Well, I don't really think of it as my idea of security. I just think of it as a Vietnam experience, sort of an unbroken scene. And the IVS was the first 4 years of IVS was the one that introduced me to the Chong community. But I was very detached from IVF, for better or for worse. The experience was phenomenal.
Well, let's remove the IVF. You went out there, you taught English in school, you became close to a lot of Vietnamese. Is this something that Americans should do?
I think it's good for Americans. I don't know how good it is for them, but you find people, somebody said, you're really one of the best Texas Peace Corps, which would be a lot of people who knew a lot about these countries and finally understood them at far greater depth than the Foreign Service ever had. I think it's probably an excellent source of people for Foreign Service officers, for AID, for any kind of international developmental work to work at that level. I won't say, I worked really with the lowest class. Everybody, all the time. Some of the kids in school are very, or by and large, differentiations in wealth weren't that enormous. Everyone sort of had the same house. No one had a car. If you worked in the cities and taught at the city high schools, basically the only probably an urban middle class. But the people who are doing ag work, the people who are doing refugee work, I imagine there was a lot of that. They were dealing with the grassroots, with the citizens. cultural connection that could be revived when the war was over. That there's a, all those chomps who know you, I'm sure you must be reading royally and things like that.
Well, I, me going back to Fong Rong is a sensitive subject for local people.
Yeah,
so I don't really know, but I see them in Saigon and that kind
of stuff. Yeah, that was a problem, by the way, that Chuck had. He went back to Fong Rong and tried to find a woman who had done his housekeeping for him. And it turned out she had become, she was considered an enemy of the state. And just asking about her led Don into, you know, Don had taken a big fight with her. And it led to no end of problems. They were jailing. And it was really bad. And Don was very upset given the clearance that he had for this group and all the history of
the clearance you get from Hanoi.
Well, that's the problem. That was the district. Yes, it was all 100% district operation. The district of the party was really upset about Chuck asking about this. And Chuck was very upset, by the way. He went all the way to Vietnam and felt it was a stupid bureaucracy and etc. But the point was that they are sensitive in that district. And I'm not surprised to hear you say that.
Well, there's me and Father Musse. Father Musse was denounced in the Communist Party Theoretical Journal about 2 years. The man who denounced him is now one of his friends. They were at a conference together at Kuala Lumpur, and the English guy, Matthew, and the Vietnamese were very embarrassed. So I, you know, and me as well, in print, first source for the CIA agent, organizing for and whatnot. So it's still a sensitive topic, and I'm not going to go there until it's, you know, gone wrong, unless it's not that, and I get an education about it.
Yes, exactly. And the major stupidity is probably, well, there are a couple of people I can think of who that I didn't get already, who identified that closely with the people that they were with. And it seems a shame that the person least likely to be a CIA, that was the maverick who wasn't even really much part of IBS, is the person that. But the problem is that there are a lot of people in Hanoi, of course. Good thing IBS is CIA.
Oh, yeah. But you know, when I was, during the time I was captured, they weren't the least interested in IBS. Maybe because they knew enough about it already. They were interested in the Ford Foundation.
Well, speaking of which, I you know, as I mentioned, I don't know, it must have been Chuck or something you mentioned that you've been, that you were captured.
Yeah.
We can discuss that and then we'll be done. How did that happen?
I was in Baton Rouge.
When that attack came in 75?
Yeah.
And what happened?
There was a council, so I just said, no exit. Camps in the jungle, re-education camps for 6 months. And that was kind of interesting to me. First of all, I'd never been in the jungle before. Had never known any North Vietnamese before. And really hadn't known Arvin very well, because he hadn't had very many. And, you know, all of a sudden we were in camps with 3,000 of them. And didn't know, you know, know them to some degree. That's why I played a few of them. There's a, it's not a proper subject for oral history of IBS. Carolyn Miller, who's in our group, wrote a book about it. So it's already preserved for posterity.
Yeah.
But it was a period that was extremely interesting with long periods of extreme boredom. As I'm getting prison experiences, you know, for anybody. We spent the last 2 months there in the north in Sun Tay.
That's in the Sun Tay Ray.
Yeah, in same place. And I ended up quite nicely with 2 days of tours in Hanoi. You know, the Vietnamese were starting to treat us pretty decently by then. And they were never bad to us. I mean, we were our guards and whatnot, you know, as soon as they start speaking Vietnamese to them, they just you know, under hostilities broke down. Couldn't mean they were far more curious about us and immune to us.
Was the assumption when you were captured that you must have been USAID or CIA or something like that?
Well, you know, we were captured with there was the AID guy from Family Tours in there, and a Filipino AID worker there. But also there was 8 missionaries, you know, husband and wife, one little girl. I mean, I think it was pretty apparent. Vietnamese were very suspicious of missionaries. They didn't like what they did. But I think that they were able to distinguish between, you know, missionaries and CIA. Still, they viewed all of us as part of the U.S. implantation in Vietnam. So, you know, not being overtly CIA, I don't think helped enormously. But I certainly think